Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, it is my pleasure to speak with Ben Epstein about his new book, The Only Constant is Change, Technology, Political Communication, and Innovation Over Time. This book was recently published by Oxford University Press. Ben's book, which traces communication changes and innovations in the United States from the time of the founding to the present, explores how and where innovative use of communication becomes viable for political actors. Ben connects a number of threads within the book, including a qualitative approach to communication studies that makes use of the American Political Development, or APD, framework as the structure to explore the disruptions in technology that allow for new forms of political communication operations to come forward and for political actors to choose to make use of these innovative forms for communication. He also examines who makes the most use of new information and communication technology, and how and where a new political communication order becomes embedded within our daily lives. This is a clearly structured book with some fascinating case studies to help us understand who may make the most out of new communication approaches and where it may or may not make that much of a difference. But I will let Ben Epstein tell us a bit more about that at length as we discuss his book, The Only Constant is Change. First, though, I would like to welcome Ben Epstein to the New Books in Political Science podcast and ask him to tell us a little bit about himself and how he came to this project. Hello, Ben.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm a big fan of the podcast, so it's a real honor to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
It's my pleasure.
So a little bit about myself, and then we can get into the project. I am an associate professor of political science at DePaul University in Chicago, and I teach mainly American politics with a focus on American political culture and especially political communication and media and politics, along with a few other things, as we all do. But and my research has it really grew out of an interest in how political communication changes over time, but also really how it connects to regular people and how they interact with politics. That's sort of how I started to think about this over time. So my evolution to try to get to this project was not something that I saw coming. It sort of emerged out of my dissertation work at the City University of New York Graduate Center, where I did my PhD work. And when I arrived to start my work in graduate school, I didn't plan on focusing on political communication. I wasn't really focused on media and politics. All of that emerged as I was studying there. And it really grew out of an interest that I've always had in history. Because before I was a college professor, before I was thinking about going to grad school, I was a high school history teacher and had a great time teaching history, and I've always loved history. But it wasn't until I made it to graduate school that I started to learn about, as you mentioned, American political development and the ways that American politics and American history have been studied in a way that really joined these two interests of mine. And eventually I was able to connect all of those in through the sort of the general concept of political communication and exploring the changes that have happened over time, which has been really exciting and have developed this, into what became an exciting dissertation and thankfully turned into a book that I'm really excited to share with people.
Yeah, I mean, you do a great job working in a lot of this historical background, and I'm going to ask you some more questions about that. But I wanted you to explain a little bit to listeners, because you are very familiar with some of the terminology in the book and what you mean by it and what communication scholars mean by it. But can you give the listeners who may not be as familiar an overview of what you mean by things like political communication order, or as you abbreviate them in the book, PCOs?
Right. Good question. A great place to start. I'll take a sort of 10,000 foot view of where this is and start by sort of describing the book as essentially following this central recurring pattern that I've identified over time called the political communication cycle, what I sometimes abbreviate as the PCC. And the political communication cycle is something that I've identified as a recurring process that incorporates the technological, political, and behavioral aspects, the gears that work together to motivate political communication innovation. So really, this book is about political communication innovation over time, how, why, and when those major changes in political communication happen. And so these abbreviations or these terms that I've used or that I've identified are, I hope, helpful, because this book is, I hope, serves for a number of different purposes. But one of those purposes is to try to help to provide some context and allow really great ongoing research in political communication changes and innovations, a way to sort of connect to each other, to connect the dots a little bit. And I've identified this recurring cycle over time that I think can provide some of that context. And you mentioned one of the key components of that, which is the political communication order. So the political communication cycle, which is this recurring process, is really made up of shifting from a political communication order, which is a relatively stable, long period of consistent methods that political organizations use communication tactics, or political actors use them. And then it eventually becomes disrupted through a combination of new technology and also political motivations that can change, and then ultimately can lead to a political communication revolution, or what I abbreviate as a PCR. And so the political communication cycle, this recurring process, which serves as the guide for the entire book, is really a way to chart how technology and politics and even external events and behavioral processes come together to move from a relatively stable period of political communication, where political actors and their audiences sort of understand how things work and do things in more or less consistent ways, and how that is then disrupted and the process of then changing to something that then again becomes stabilized with a new set of tools that are trying to do essentially old things in new and better ways. So one of the overall sort of fundamental pieces that I keep coming back to in this book and in related work is that political communication goals have always remained fairly constant. That campaigns, for instance,
the goals don't change. You want to win.
Yeah, the goals don't change. Exactly. If you're running a campaign in 1820 and you're running a campaign in 2020, right? You're going to be trying to do the same thing. You want to win, and you're going to be trying to reach voters to get them to turn out. So your goals are not going to change. What changes dramatically are the tactics and the strategies and the tools that you use to achieve those goals. So much of what I'm trying to accomplish and really explore in this book is how during relatively short periods of time, but in the same recurring process, these strategies have changed dramatically. And then we eventually get to a relatively stable period, a new sort of status quo. And that's the political communication order that reemerges before eventually a new revolutionary process will begin.
Got it. The goals remain the same, but the way that people go about them, as you note, have these disruptions.
Right.
I think this is a really important and fascinating sort of component of your book with regard to exploring when these disruptions happened. And you also, you know, sort of put them in the historical context, but in the political cycle. And you frame this, as I already mentioned, and you mentioned, you know, through this APD, American Political Development Framework. Can you explain a little bit more about why the APD framework and sort of cycles of change was instrumental for your study?
Sure. As I mentioned, when I started in graduate school, I have to admit, I had never heard of American political development. I did not know it existed. I was lucky to study under Andy Polsky, who is at Hunter College and part of the CUNY system. And he is really an expert in American political development. And what I really learned from this is that what I've always how I've always talked about history as being something that we can both learn from, but also understand that pieces will, you know, elements will be similar to what we might see today and are very instructive today, that American political development is largely looking at that process, at looking at politics over time, and primarily in the American context, looking at institutions, how they develop, how they change, how they influence politics and political behavior, and then generally trying to identify trends and potentially patterns over time, looking at how history can connect with today, and then ultimately how that can be used to get a greater sense of how presidents, past, present, and potentially future might be connected to one another, how other institutions, or in the case of this book, how political communication and political communication innovations are actually fairly consistent when viewed within a broader contextualized historical context. And for me, this book is very interdisciplinary, and APD served as a really foundational part of that interdisciplinary process that tries to bring in communication studies and also work from diffusion of innovations research. And then APD was a nice bridge to help connect a lot of those pieces.
Yeah, and you also note sort of some of the threads from sociology and economics as well coming together into your study. And it is a wonderfully interdisciplinary book, and I recommend it on that basis, among other reasons. But I want to now get you to tell us a little bit about the central theses of the book. And you talk about three claims that you're sort of going to make, or that you make in the context of the book, about the decline of the costs and thus the opportunity for adoption of new technological mechanisms, about how a political actor with more resources of a number of kinds is more likely to innovate, and finally, why political challengers are more likely to innovate than those already in power or in elected office. Can you expand a bit on each of these and explain why they come together to sort of form the focal point for your study?
Sure. That's a really, really nice way to get into some of the content here. I think if I start by explaining the actual cyclical process, then it helps to make it clear why these three claims really make a lot of sense. The political communication cycle starts with a technological stage, and that technological stage really begins with an important new information technology that emerges, whether it be the radio or the internet or something potentially transformative. As that new technology becomes widely used and becomes popular throughout society, it gains what I like to call political viability. It potentially could be used for political communication in the way that we've already discussed towards these long-standing goals. And if that's the case, then possibly new types of political organizations or actors could try to use these new tools to try to essentially do what they've always tried to do, but do it in new and better ways. And if they're successful, which is a big if, then that could potentially be copied and imitated and eventually lead to a new status quo emerging. That's generally how this cycle works. And so in terms of these three claims that are central to the study, the first one, as you said, being this cost claim, that the cost of new technologies, as the cost of new technologies decline, then the potential for the incorporation into this political communication activity increases. That really has to do with barriers to early adoption of really any new technology or any new innovation. And there are barriers, of all different types, but one of the fundamental ones is the cost of new technology. And if we think about how that connects to early radios, for instance, or early black and white televisions in the late 1940s and early 1950s, they were astronomically expensive when we compare them to what you could eventually get a television for just a few years later. And that makes it not only harder for individual consumers to buy them, but it means that it's less likely for for people to, for political organizations to want to innovate, to try to use those new tools. And so as the cost declines, then it is obviously going to be used by more people. It's going to be more accessible. And then the potential use for politicians will increase. So that cost claim is really connected to the naturally occurring sort of economic realities of new technologies as they emerge. In terms of the second and third claims, which are really connected in some ways, they're really about the political actors themselves. So part of this book is about the new innovations, the technologies, but a lot of previous work focuses too much on just the technology and often almost talks about it as technological determinism, that, oh, the radio came about and the next thing was Franklin Roosevelt. And we were going to have, you know, these things, it has all just happened because the radio changed everything. And now the internet came about and everything is going to change. And I don't believe that's the case. I think that the actors choose if and when and how they're going to make these big leaps and often risk a lot in making these big innovations. And so the second claim, talking about political actors with greater financial and technological resources as more likely to innovate earlier than others, is really important because it talks about not who might want to innovate, but who could potentially innovate earlier. And I talk about it in terms of an idea that I take from Diffusion of Innovation scholarship called innovativeness, essentially the measure of how likely you are to innovate earlier or later. And we can all think about for ourselves when we first our iPhone, or, you know, I'm thinking of when I was in college, my parents, I love them to death, but they waited until I went to college before they got cable television. And so all of my friends had cable, and my sister, who's younger than me and is wonderful, she was able to enjoy cable at home when I, you know, but after I went to college, and I was waiting for them to innovate, and they had their reasons why they wanted to wait and be one of the last people on earth to get cable TV. But that was their their choice. I know about why and when I got my first cell phone, and I talk about that a little bit in the book. And for me, that was connected to 9/11 in a interesting way. But why we innovate individually is motivated in much the same way that political organizations and political actors innovate. And so, if you want to innovate, that's one thing. If you have the resources, whether they're financial or technological, to actually make those leaps, you're more likely to do it earlier than later for political actors. And finally, the third claim, that political challengers or outsiders are more likely to innovate earlier than others, is just based on the political risks involved. If you are a political actor currently in power, right? If you're a candidate, if you're an incumbent, for instance, you are less likely to want to do a major innovation in how you do things because you want to keep things more or less the way they are. You might incrementally change how you run your campaign or how you communicate to certain potential voters. But if you're an outside candidate, if you are someone with less political capital already, you have less to risk. You're more likely to take a big gamble and innovate earlier than others, especially if you have the resources to do so. So these claims can sort of connect to one another and help to give a clearer idea of when new technologies might be viable for successful innovation, and also when actors or organizations might actually be able to take advantage of those opportunities and try to innovate themselves.
That's so incredibly helpful to think about the three claims and how they're connected to one another. And I wanted to ask you, in this context and given the sort of the research in the book, can you point listeners a bit towards some of the political communication revolutions that have transpired in the United States? I mean, I think we can think about some of them, obviously this radio and FDR and the fireside chats and so forth. But your book goes into a lot of historical detail. And I would love for you to provide just a couple of examples of, where you see some of these interesting components coming together.
Sure. I think I've mentioned now several times, I just love history. And one of the most fun parts of writing this book and doing this project over many years was diving into these, you know, really interesting historical, you know, narratives and examples of things that I had never heard of before. And when it came together and when I connected it to this political communication cycle overall, I identified four political communication orders, those long stable periods that we've talked about, and three intervening disruptive political communication revolutions. And so the first political communication order, what I call the elite political communication order, really existed from the colonial era all the way through the 1830s or so. And that period was really dominated by obviously print technology. There was no radio, there was, you know, no Facebook. And so that print era was primarily created by and largely for political and business elites. So you had relatively small readership and a growing number of newspapers, but that really was fairly consistent over time, where you have this very slowly emerging printing process, partly because it was so expensive and difficult to actually make newspapers, which I go into in great detail in the second chapter, but also because the actual demand for them was limited to the people who could pay for them and actually who could read them and potentially use them. The first major revolutions, the political communication cycles that happens, really emerges in the early decades of the 19th century, and by the 1820s and 1830s really starts to change into the second political communication order, what I call the mass political communication order, and that's when we really see the first emergence of a mass media in this country. And it's not because the medium changes, because we're still talking about a print era, but we're talking about a print era that is suddenly accessible to almost everyone, regardless of class. And that's a major change. And it changes because of a number of different pieces. It changes first because newspapers are cheaper to produce. The technology in printing, the technology in paper making comes down dramatically. But also the demand for them increases for a couple of reasons. One, you just have an increase in literacy during that time. You have greater education. You have more people that can read. Also, you have greater political opportunities because the suffrage rights are coming away. You have universal male suffrage by the 1820s just about everywhere. And so there are more people that are interested in political information, and therefore political information is going to be written for more of the general audience. You also see some infrastructure changes that help newspapers disseminate very quickly. And all of that comes together to radically redefine not only the political makeup of the country, but how we can communicate about that. And then you layer in some business changes that happen, especially with the penny press emerging in 1833, where suddenly anyone can go on the street corner and buy a newspaper for a penny, as it obviously is aptly called, the penny press, as opposed to what previously you could only get through a subscription, and that subscription was too expensive for most people to have on a regular basis. And so suddenly you have this ability to use this medium that isn't new in a totally new and different way that redefines how newspapers work, who they're written for, what sort of information they're going to be interested in. And all this is emerging as political parties are reforming how the process works. And it's all happening in a relatively concentrated time that forever it will change how political communication works in this country. And that then is more or less the order that is in place for nearly 100 years until the radio displaces that. The radio obviously is an incredibly important technological innovation. It brings in what I call the broadcast political communication order. And while some people don't necessarily agree with me, I link radio and television, even though television was obviously incredibly important on its own for many, many reasons, they together redefine the relationship that sources of political communication and audiences of political communication have. They make political communication much more personal, much more immediate, and there's more of an emotional connection between watching a speech or hearing FDR's fireside chats as opposed to reading George Washington's farewell address, for instance. And so it doesn't feel the same way. And that might be obvious, but the process of trying to use the radio for politics and usually using it poorly, and then eventually over several years, actually over a decade of sort of trying things out, eventually it becomes a mainstay in American politics and becomes really organized by new regulations, by new tools, and becomes this stable order that the television was then incorporated into until you get to really the 1990s, until the internet really radically reshapes or starts to reshape how political communication can work. And obviously, not to fast forward, but a few things have changed since the mid 1990s in terms of how we get and generate and curate and share political information, and we're in the midst of that political communication cycle right now. So that's a big part of it.
So we're still in the revolution, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, that's a great question. No, I think is the short answer, because I think the political communication cycle charts this process from stable political communication order through a cycle of revolution to another stable order. And there are three phases: the technological phase, the second phase, which is, I think, the most important, called political choice, which is all about the behavioral choices of when and how and if political organizations make their innovations. And then the final stage is what I call stabilization. And stabilization is the process of these radical permanent changes becoming stabilized through both changes in norms, how political actors and how political audiences use these tools, but also in new regulations and new institutions. And I think that if we look at that cycle and we look at what's happened over the last 20 years, we're clearly in that third phase. We're past any experimental part. The internet definitely helps impact politics. I don't think no political organizations are wondering, should I be on social media? Right? It's not a question. And so, to use Rasmus Kleist-Nielsen's work, he talks about the mundane internet tools, and some of these tools that once were really exciting and really new and were groundbreaking, like email, are no longer interesting, right? They're things that everyone uses. They're mundane. But the fact that they're mundane is exactly why they're so powerful, because they're used by all kinds of people all the time without even thinking about them. And no political campaign, no political organization would think about some sort of communication outreach strategy that doesn't include them. So we're past the early trials. We're even past the copying of things that work. We're in the final third phase of this process where we're starting to stabilize what this recent revolutionary cycle was, and that will largely dictate, I think, where we're going to be going over the next 5, 10, maybe even 20 years down the road, and regulatory processes and new norms of how organizations work and how the public consumers of political information interact with and use these new tools, those will largely dictate, I think, how our current cycle really becomes stabilized.
Yeah, that certainly makes a lot of sense, given all the discussions about how to regulate Twitter and Facebook and social media and so forth at the moment.
Yeah.
Around electioneering and communication, as you note. So I wanted to ask another question that sort of takes you through a little bit of the history that you do such a great job with in the book. And this study only applies to the United States. And your work on the political and cyclical history of technological innovation, as it applies to politics, is really interesting and I think useful for other places. But can you explain a bit about why this is possibly unique for or in the United States at this moment, but perhaps may not be forever?
Yeah, that's a really useful question. I appreciate that. I write in the introduction that in one way, this book is really broad, and it paints in very broad strokes, and that's the sort of breadth of history that I'm trying to cover, right? Over 300 years of history. One way that the book is a little bit more narrow, as you described, is in geography, right? It's only going to be focused on the American case But I describe that I don't believe in any way that the political communication cycle is an American phenomenon. I think that how the technological changes were applied and when they became more widespread in the United States was different than the timing and the rate of diffusion that some of these technologies might have come into play in other parts of the world. We know that the internet, for instance, or cell phones or recent technologies diffuse differently in different places, and that's always been the case. So I think that the American context of how the political communication cycle can be applied is unique in terms of when these disruptive periods were and when these relatively stable periods were. But at the same time, I believe that this political communication cycle, I hope, will be a really useful context and useful set of tools and some terminology that can be applied all over the world. And so I think that, if we look at, South Korea, one of the most technologically advanced countries in the world, well, how quickly new technology is adapted by the majority of people in South Korea will change how that can be used by political organizations in that country. And so the process is the same, but the actual orders and the actual process will probably be different. But I think that the general pieces fit together in the same way. They're the same gears that are working. Some countries are going to be more authoritarian. Some regions within nations could be, could work very differently. We know that adoption of radios in the United States were very different in rural America than urban America. All of those are important nuances and really important distinctions. And there are great studies on all of these small pieces. What I haven't seen very much of, and what I hope the book will help to provide, is a way to connect some of those really great studies in some, with some helpful historical context.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to see some of this applied to places like Israel, which also has a history of innovation, particularly technological innovation, or India, which are sort of leapfrogging over aspects of technological innovation, and how some of these communication strategies become more the norm in other places as well. And I wanted to ask you, towards the end of the book, you integrate an interesting comparative case study. So you've gone along in the book, and it's really fascinating looking at how political actors, politicians, elected officials make use of communication technology, where some of the innovation happens, how they capitalize on it. But then towards the end, you examine interest groups. You have, I think, four interest groups that you look at that are sort of also working with these technological innovations in a slightly different way, because they're doing communication narratives, but they're doing it somewhat differently. So can you tell us a little bit about this particular comparative case study? Obviously, it's in the United States, but the difference in terms of the political actors and interest groups versus those running for elected office.
Sure. I have three chapters that are focused on different case studies. One on campaigns, as you mentioned. There's another chapter that focuses on social movements and sort of marginalized groups over time. And then there's the final case study is, as you said, on interest groups. And the interest group chapter is probably the most helpful way to illustrate how different political communication or how different organizations, I should say, are trying to do similar things, but through different goals. And so I mentioned earlier that political communication goals remain fairly consistent over time, but the strategies that are used to achieve those goals change. I think that interest groups are the best example of that, because one thing that is very different about interest groups is who their political communication targets are. Who are they trying to reach? Campaigns are trying to reach as many people as possible. They want to get to potential voters. They want voters to potentially turn out and help them win elections. Social movements are trying to do similar things, trying to reach a larger audience, because ultimately the audience that they already are involved with are are not enough to change their political opportunities. But interest groups are playing insider politics, right? Interest groups have, they already have relationships with policymakers and power brokers at local and state and national level. So interest groups are not necessarily trying to reach broad audiences in new and better ways. They might be incentivized to reach their target power holding audiences in new and different ways, but you're going to use different tools to reach a broad audience as opposed to a more narrowly targeted audience. And so interest groups simply had less of an incentive to innovate how they use communication tools, because while they wanted to get supporters, they wanted to get members, ultimately who they were trying to influence most were the people that that they already had connections to. And so their sort of innovation, their information communications had to do with outreach and trying to improve and increase their membership. They became more political. I speak specifically of the NRA and also this, the Sierra Club, that both became more political over time. But ultimately, until the internet and until this really dramatic change in the democratizing potential of how the internet can reshape how interest groups work in the MoveOn era and post MoveOn, using the MoveOn model of Dave Karp's work, we really don't see major changes. So interest groups that have been around for the entirety of American political history did not innovate in near the same way at near the same rate, because they didn't have to until very recently. And then we start to see some major changes, and some of the legacy interest groups are trying to update how they do things. And there are a lot of newer interest groups that are organizing, essentially following these relatively new web-based models that are less bureaucratic and more horizontal in structure. And so but ultimately it's because the political communication goals of interest groups are very different from the goals of those other organizations, we see the process of innovation happening over time in a very different way.
And that brings me to my next question, which is, why is so much of this understanding of previous revolutionary periods, if we can use that term, important to us now? What do we learn about our current political dynamic and the future political dynamics from our understanding of these disruptions within political communication?
Yeah, that is the question that 94% of all of my high school history students all ask me, right? Why should we learn this stuff, right? Why should we focus on history, and what does it mean for us today and possibly tomorrow? And if we can't answer that question, then I don't think we're doing a great job with this stuff. I think that one of the major benefits of this book is that it helps us understand where we are in a process that isn't always in constant change. Even though it feels like we are living in an era of constant innovation and new changes in how we get information and how people communicate, it feels like it's an all the time, never ending process. It's actually not. And especially when we focus on political communication, because political communication is a different subset than broader social communication. There are very clear processes and eras, like we've talked about, of major change and then relative stability. Not that nothing changes, but relative stability compared to those revolutionary periods. And as we mentioned earlier, right now, if we look throughout all of American political communication history and we see how these things have changed and when and how actors and organizations and institutions and laws, how all these things have changed over time and more or less, then we start to see where we are now. And where we are now is in the later stages of this revolutionary cycle, which suggests that the decisions that we make over the next few years in terms of net neutrality, in terms of mergers and acquisitions of major telecommunication companies, the power that Google and Facebook and Apple have in self-regulating, or whether the FCC or Congress takes control of where that goes, ultimately those decisions are really what will set the stage for a very stable era of political communication. That doesn't mean that we won't have new innovations, that there won't be new Apple products that change people's lives, and that that we might be looking at holograms in a few years, or virtual reality, used all the time. All these things will potentially happen, but politicians and political organizations like stability. And so what they often will build in is a way that we will consistently use certain tools. And we've already seen that. We look at just the changes over the last few electoral cycles, and campaigns are usually a great way to look at these changes over time because they're so regular. If you look at the social media platforms that were used in 2008 and 2012 and then in 2016, even though the campaigns were very different, right? Obama's campaign and Romney's campaign, and fast forwarding to Clinton and Trump and Sanders even in 2016, the campaigns felt very different. But the tools that were used went from a number of different tools that were being used in 2008 to the exact same tools used in similar ways in 2016. It wasn't that the content was the same. It wasn't that Clinton's messages were the same as Trump's, obviously. But they actually were using the same tools in more or less the same ways. And that form of stabilization is, I think, a good example of how the norms of political communication change, become more stable over time. And if we know that, then we know how important the era that we're living in right now is, because the decisions that either we make or that political organizations make or that Congress makes will help really set the tone for, I think, the reality that we'll be living in for potentially decades to come.
So that Mark Zuckerberg's sort of testimony in front of the Senate a couple weeks ago or whenever it was is important to think about in terms of what Mark Zuckerberg understands about media and communication, and what many of the older members of the Senate understand about media and communication.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was amazing listening to some of the older members of the Senate saying, so how does Facebook work again? And yeah, it was exactly right. That's exactly right.
So this is a great book to read from a number of different perspectives: political science and economics and business innovation. So I want to know, Ben, what are you working on now?
When you spend 8 years working on a book project, then you have to think, well, what comes next? And there's a lot of really exciting projects that I'm a part of. I've been working on a long project with a couple of great colleagues, Jennifer Connolly and Letitia Bodie, on looking at e-government and looking at how local governments use different tools differently to interact with their constituents. That's been really exciting. I'm doing a lot of work on how email was used in 2016, and looking forward, really growing out of one of the chapters of this book, chapter 6, that looked at social movements and marginalized groups, which is really where my interest originated and is always focused, which is on groups that are politically marginalized. And so one thing that I'm really starting to dive into is how marginalized groups over time have tried to use innovative techniques to try to change their political fortunes, and what can work and what often does not work, and why. And I think that looking at how these different groups try to change the way that, to use Schottschneider's terminology, how they change the scope of conflict, that's been a real interesting puzzle that I'm excited to work on moving forward.
So when you finish that book, will you come back on the New Books Network and talk to me about it?
It would be my pleasure. Yeah, absolutely.
Great. So I want to know, and the listeners want to know, where they can buy The Only Constant Is Change: Technology, Political Communication, and Innovation Over Time. I know it's published by Oxford University Press, and we all know there are various places where we can buy books on the internet. Is there any place else that one might want to pick up a copy of your book?
Sure. Well, I am always a huge fan of my local bookstores, and relatively close to my house in Chicago, is a great bookstore called The Bookseller in Lincoln Square. It's a fantastic place. It serves our community really well. And that, if you are in Chicago, would be a great place to look for the book.
Thank you. Thank you for joining me today, Ben Epstein. It's great to talk to you about this great book about constancy and change in technology.
Thanks so much, Lily. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.